This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.
Hello, everybody. This is Patricia W. Fisher with Readers Entertainment Radio, and I cannot believe it's already May, which is just the year is just flying by. And this day in history, in 1933, the first published modern-day sighting of the Loch Ness Monster happened in the Inverness Courier. So look that up today. She made her debut there, and the whole world knew about her at that point. And then we also have this month is Foster Care Awareness Month. This is a subject very near and dear to my heart, as my husband and I have adopted two children from foster care. And this year we will celebrate 7 years of the day that they walk through our doors. So if you ever have any questions about foster care, please ask someone that can give you some really solid, wonderful answers, because there's a lot of kids out there who are in need of homes. But today we are going to talk to a fabulous author named Dan Stout, who lives in Columbus, Ohio, where he writes about fever dreams and half-glimpsed shapes in the shadows. His prize-winning fiction draws on his travels throughout Europe, Asia, and the Pacific Rim, as well as an employment history spanning everything from subpoena server to assistant well driller. Dan's stories have appeared in publications such as the Saturday Evening Post, Nature, and Mad Science Journal. His debut novel, Titan Shade, is the first volume of the Carter Archives. You can find him on Facebook or your social media of choice, including Twitter, Instagram, and Goodreads. And all of those links are in the write-up of the show. So welcome today, Mr. Dan Stout. How are you?
I'm so great, Patricia. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So tell me, a lot of authors that come on talk about they were just really avid readers as a kid. Were you one of those people?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was a real library rat. So you learn to ride your bike, and one of the first places I was allowed to go down by myself was the local library. And I would just go down there and get as many books as I could cram into my backpack and book on home and hang out in the backyard with the dog and spend all summer reading out there.
You know, you and I've talked to so many people that, you know, they'd fill their bag. That's one of the things. They would fill their bags full of books from the library and go home. And there's so many kids that still do this. So growing up, did you ever think, I'm going to have a book in the library one day?
Well, I don't know if I ever actually believed it, but I do remember early on figuring out that somebody was actually writing these stories and they were doing that for a living. And it seemed like the best possible of all jobs. And I'm pretty delighted to be in a position where I got that now.
Right. So you've done all these great jobs. You like a Renaissance man of sorts. I think a lot of us go through this where we do whatever pays the bill sometimes.
Yep.
And so how did you get from, let's say, subpoena server to now? I mean, what was your journey to get to be a published writer?
Well, I had always played around with writing, but I could never really cross the line from sketching up little vignettes to actually telling a story. And it wasn't until about 2012 when my dad passed away, and I sat down and I really wanted to do something special for the eulogy. And I told a story in his eulogy, and it connected with people on a really personal level. And partly, you know, it was my dad's funeral, so naturally I was invested emotionally. But people came up to me and had a really strong reaction. And the priest who was at the funeral actually asked if he could use it in other funeral services later. So I knew that I'd stumbled onto something without really realizing it. And what I had done is I'd figured out story structure. And that kind of structure is what was missing in all my creative writing classes and in all my attempts at writing short stories before that. So I decided that I was going to take it seriously and start writing. And I started doing that, you know, on early mornings and nights and weekends. And around 2014, I was working in the construction industry and I lost my job. And, you know, like most people, it's not expected when a company you work for goes under. So I was scrambling to find a way to keep money or keep money coming in, keep food on the table. And you mentioned foster care awareness. We had just gotten our first foster child. around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really important to keep everything stable. And so I was doing anything I could do to work, and I started doing content marketing and writing that way. And I realized
okay.
that, hey, I could actually get paid to write. It wasn't fiction, but it was something. And as I did that more and more, I was able to blend my nonfiction with writing fiction and started to get some success in sales that way. And eventually, over
mm-hmm.
time, I've been able to make that transfer to writing full-time between the fiction and the nonfiction.
It's interesting because I think a lot of people believe, you know, when you're a writer, you write one thing. And you and me and a lot of other of us are out here writing. It's like having all the baskets and just having different baskets that you fill. Is it hard to juggle the fiction and nonfiction for you?
It can be, especially when it feels like I've been using the same mental muscles all day to do
uh-huh.
nonfiction and I have to switch to fiction. I can be tired at the end of the day and I just don't have it in me to write. Whereas when I was working in construction, I was physically tired. I had aching muscles, but if I came home, I wanted to write. I'd been waiting to do it all day long. So there's a little bit
right.
of motivation issue there. And that's just, you know, that's just part of being an adult and having to, you know, kick yourself in the seat of the pants and get moving when you have to.
That's right. Exactly. So you mentioned that you had your first foster placement in 2014. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. So it would have been end of 2013 to beginning 2014.
Were you able to adopt the child, or was that the were you just fostering, or were you fostering adopt? What was the plan?
We have only fostered for short term, so like 6 months, 9 months. And
mm-hmm.
we've always been able to see the child reunited with their parents.
Okay.
And there's, you know, there's different courses and different situations. Obviously, every child and their situation is unique. But the ones where we've been working with were ones where there needed to be a short-term removal from the home for whatever reason. And then the social workers worked with the parents to help rectify the situation, and they were able to reunite the family, which is pretty wonderful to be part of. Feel like you really did something worthwhile at the end of it.
And so, you know, a lot of people have asked me, and I know we're getting off the subject of the book, and I promise we'll get back to your book, but one of the things that a lot of people ask me is, why would people only foster? Why wouldn't your goal be adoption? What was y'all's approach to that?
Well, it depends with every situation, right? Because sometimes
sure.
you're in a situation where that child needs to be removed from that house permanently. And
yes.
that's the situation, and that's the harsh reality. But there's other times when you look at it, you sit down with a social worker, you take the child in, and you realize that they might have like a single parent who simply couldn't handle themselves in the workplace for a short period of time or whatever. They needed some training. They needed some assistance. And at
mm-hmm.
the end of the day, I could never be the guy who looks at this kid. I'm trying to help him or her out. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, I hope your parent fails to get their act together so that I can adopt
sure.
you. You know, there's got to be working for that unification if it's something that's salvageable and if it's something that can work out.
Right.
And for the people who foster to adopt, it's usually a completely different situation. It's not a short-term
mm-hmm.
separation. It's either a bigger issue or a parent who's never able to take care proper care of the child to begin with.
Right. Right. And what we've noticed too, it was interesting when we went through training, is, you know, everybody wants the for sures and the all that. And our trainer, our teacher was so good. She said, look, this can change in an hour. You could have a situation where it absolutely looks like they're going to be reunited with their family. Like grandma says she wants to take the children
mm-hmm.
and then she decides, you know what, I don't. And so
yeah.
it's you have to be available for those kind of shifts, but also you could have the opposite where it looks like families don't have to get it together and they do. But you have to hold on to the idea that you gave this child an extremely safe, stable environment in the meantime. And it's something they probably had been lacking in their lives, whether it was just through general ignorance of the family or truly wanting to do right by the child and just doesn't have the resources, doesn't know how to ask, or you have a situation where they just really don't want to. Either way, the what you provide as foster parents is essential and crucial.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the parents and the organizations that we worked with through Foster were all top notch and top quality. Mm-hmm. I was so impressed with the work that everybody put into it and how serious everybody took it. They all knew what was at stake when you're intervening in a child's life that way. I'm very pleased and proud to say that that was something that we've done.
That's very cool. Well, thank you for doing that. It's a big deal. So I really, really appreciate you doing that. But so now let's shift back, and I'm sure that you have plenty of stories you can write about and situations you can write about as a foster dad. So just, you know, putting that little nugget in there for you so you don't have anything else to do in your life. But let's get back to your book. So tell me, you're writing and writing and writing, and now you decide you're going to write this book and this series. Tell me how you came about this idea.
I used to take part on a website, a weekly website flash fiction challenge. It was called Liberty Hall.
Okay.
Sadly, it's not around anymore. But what it was is if you were a member of this website on Friday, you could go in anytime over the weekend. You'd click a button, and they would give you a prompt, and a timer would start. And you had 90 minutes to write as much of a story as you could. And then everybody put them in. They were anonymous on the website, and then we would all read each other's story and give feedback. And what was brilliant about it is because everybody had the same 90-minute time constraint, so nobody's was all that good. Every now and then somebody would come out with something fully formed, but usually they were the best attempts. And because it was a weekly challenge, it encouraged you to try all kinds of different genres and styles and formats and POVs. So it was a fantastic exercise. And one prompt created spark with me, and it connected a bunch of things in the back of my head. And I came up with the first chapter of Titan Shade, along with just a brief sketch of the book. And that launched it. I just fell in love with the character and the world, and I started playing with it from there.
So did you plot out the first book, or did you plot out the first book along with a whole series? Did you see like this really big panoramic picture, or just this book first?
I really focused on just this book. And because it's my debut novel, it represents the absolute limit of my skill set. I really pushed myself as much as I could. But there are so many plates you have to keep spinning when you're working at novel lengths. I know people who can plot out entire series and multiple story arcs and all kinds of stuff. And I'm honestly a little bit in awe of them. I'm just amazed that they can do that. I am much more of a one foot in front of the other plotting methodical worker.
Yes. We just went to see Endgame, and no spoilers, but it was amazing to me, all of the threads and the story threads that they've pulled through all 22 of these movies. I mean, I remember talking to friends of mine. I'm like, I would have loved to have just been sitting in the writer's room and seeing the storyboards to see all of the different storylines they were pulling through all 22 movies.
Yeah, it is really amazing.
And the big picture, that's just massive. So tell me about Titan Shade.
Well, Titan Shade is a gritty 1970s cop drama set in a fantasy world with magic monsters and a struggling petroleum industry. Follows a police detective named Carter as he gets sucked into a murder investigation that has serious political ramifications. And as the pressure to close the case quickly escalates, things just go from bad to worse. There's the possibility of all-out riots and madness on the streets of Titan Shade. And it's a really fun book. I've been calling, like I said, it's got a buddy cop element. I've been calling it Men in Black Meets Chinatown.
Okay. Okay. And yeah, and looking at the cover, it's definitely a, Men in Black would be a good way to put it. So Carter is the gentleman with the glasses, and the gentleman standing next to him is who?
That's Ajax, his partner okay. that he's been assigned.
Okay. And Ajax has a very intense grin. So when you look at the cover, you'll notice his grin. So what made you go with this kind of fiction as opposed to, say, just, you know, mainstream cop drama or thriller? Or why the fantasy element in there?
You know, I think for me, as a kid, you know, when I would load up my backpack and take it out to my backyard and read all day, you know, I would read things like Lord of the Rings or the Dragonlance books,
uh-huh.
And I loved right. them. But I would always wonder what would happen in these worlds when technology advanced. What would happen when they
sure.
created the internal combustion engine? And so I always wondered what would happen in a fantasy world when the technology caught up to a level closer to ours. And so I placed my story in a world, it's not Middle Earth, but it's that same kind of secondary world fantasy, but it's
sure.
1970s technology. So we've got disco and pagers and payphones and congested traffic. And it's
yes.
it's a really interesting subgenre, and there's more and more people playing in that kind of sandbox in the last 10 or 12 years.
Well, it's kind of crazy to think that that's considered historical in a way, because I was born in 67. So
mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, all that stuff, of course, standing on the seat in the car, not wearing a seatbelt, and everybody smoked.
Yep.
You know, you didn't have the charger in the car. It was a cigarette lighter. And, you know, hitting everyone had more of a stick shift versus an automatic. I mean, there's just all these different things that have changed. And it's funny because my kids will watch different things and they'll say, what are they doing? Oh, well, you have to stand there. There's a cord on the phone. You have to stand by the phone. So when you're going back and doing the research, what were some of the things that you were like, oh, yeah, we had to do that? I mean, what were some of the fond memories or the not-so-fond memories of the technology that you remembered?
Yeah, the corded phones, like those pigtail cords that would wind up and crinkle up, and they'd be all like a big ball of, you know, mess hanging down from the phone, and you'd have to unwind it every now and then.
Oh.
That's one of the great fun things. Another was kind of going through and remembering, you know, what were the cars like, you know, manual everything, manual locks, manual
right.
windows. The interesting thing about the 70s is that because it was recent enough to the internet revolution, when there was a big rush to digitize databases, 70s weren't really viewed mm-hmm. as historical, you know. So
uh-huh.
they didn't get scanned in and digitized in the same way that stuff from the 20s or the late 19th century was. So when I go to research things, there's not as much stuff online as there is about the 40s, for example. So
right.
I spend a lot of time digging through trying to find primary sources in secondhand bookstores and libraries, things like that. So, like, there's plenty of online resources about forensic science, but it's all modern. There's nothing in there about what it was like in the 1970s. So, that kind of thing.
Wow. I mean, I was laughing thinking about it. It's like, well, you could go back and watch TV shows like, you know, Starsky and
yeah.
Hutch and the Brady Bunch and, you know, The Streets of San Francisco. And it's fun to go back and see some of those TV shows because I'll see my kids go, hey, isn't that so-and-so's dad on, you know, such and such show? Isn't that Hank Pym from, you know, Ant-Man? Like, yes, he was, you know, on a show called Streets of San Francisco. So, yeah, it's you, I guess we all think that we're never going to be the parent that's having to tell our kids about someone. It's just, it's weird to be in that different position, to be the parent saying, oh yeah, I remember when I was your age and blah, blah, blah. It's fun, but also food made a big difference too at that time, because microwaves were coming or came. Mm-hmm. And that was a big change too. But you also had the women's revolution, where women were going to work. I mean, there was a lot of shifts in the 70s. It was a big time.
It absolutely was, yeah. So being able to go back and pick and choose what I want to focus on. One of the advantages of working mm-hmm. in a fantasy world is that, you know, if I get into a spot where I don't really know how one specific aspect worked, whatever it is, I can have a little built-in fudge factor. But once I make that decision, and once I say, like, okay, they have early pager technology, really simplified, just number on a green-on-green display, I have to stick with that, and I can't tweak it one way or another. For what I am trying to find a way to have somebody have one of those early cell phones with, like, a backpack and a, you know, 10-pound cell phone that they had in the late 70s uh-huh. in cars, you know, the giant antenna on the back.
So. Yes, that bumped if you went into a garage and it would, like, you're worried it would knock it off. Yeah. All these things. So inconvenient. So tell me about, so you've got this first, and it's the Carter Archive, so I'm assuming that you're going to have more books in the series.
That's right. The next book comes out next year, just about a year from now.
Okay.
And I'm polishing it up right now and playing with it and having just so much fun. The biggest struggle for me on the second book has been trying to decide what I wanted to put in, because everything that occurred to me during the first book just went into a notebook for the sequel. And when I sat down to write that, I probably had 3 books worth of stuff, and I had to pare it down because I want to share, like, all these cool things that I've come up with. But you know how it is. You can't put everything into the book. You have to hold some back.
Yes. Cause you got to have something next. And I think that it's fun, because have you had, like, a secondary character that you had, you know, plotted out initially that was, okay, you know, he's there or she's there. And then they became kind of their own thing as you were writing, somebody who said, you know, I have more of a presence than you thought.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, people will kind of start to bubble up to the surface. And another mm-hmm. thing that I've found is sometimes when you're writing that rough draft, you'll have one character in a chapter and a secondary character in another chapter. And what you realize is it's much more interesting to have it the same person reappear multiple times so that we can see how they're reacting to all the events in the story. It gives it a feel of being more lived in, and the idea that the events are having more of a ripple effect in a realistic fashion.
Right. So what's your feedback been from readers? Have they been, because I'm looking at some of your reviews and they're fabulous. So what has been your favorite so far?
I'll tell you what, there's been a lot of things that people have said that have just absolutely delighted me. I saw one person, I was on social media saying they can't stop thinking about it, and it's given them a book hangover. I thought that was pretty funny.
See, but I love it when they say they get a book hangover from your book. That's just like the huge, the biggest compliment.
It really is. And then the other thing is that I've seen a couple people who have backgrounds either in drilling or in police service. And they've mm-hmm. said that they felt like I got them. I got their background and I got the way they interact with their comrades on the job. And that meant a lot to me, the idea that I was able to convey a little bit of what those experiences are like.
And who did you talk to, people in the police force, for your research?
I did. I used some online resources, reached out to people in forums. There is a local group here to Columbus that's a chapter of Sisters in Crime. So I'm a member of Sisters in Crime, and I go to their meetings, and they had a full one-day retreat where they brought in a bunch of police officers from different parts of Ohio and who worked in different parts of law enforcement to just come in and talk about everything from chasing fugitives to getting search warrants to doing underwater search and searches for, you know, discarded weapons and things like that. And that's amazing.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that you're part of a writers group, Sisters in Crime. There's one here in Texas as well, and they one of the ladies said that the reason you want to be in a writers group is because you don't have to explain why you're writing the story. You can just start with, I have this idea, and you are in a room of people who are like, oh, well, tell me about it, and here you go. Do you recommend people be parts of writing groups as they're trying to find their strengths and weaknesses of their writing?
I absolutely do. You know, and everybody is, again, everybody is unique. And what you may find is you have to go through several different writing groups until you find one that clicks with you and where you are
exactly
in your career and your personality. So don't be afraid if you try one and it doesn't feel right for whatever reason, don't be afraid to move on and try a different one. Try online groups. Like I mentioned, Liberty Hall was a great group for me. And then try local groups as well, because it's great to see people, you know, look people in the eye and talk about stories. And making up people for a living is pretty fun and a great thing to talk about.
Oh, for sure. And I think, too, if you're part of a local group, a lot of times, like here, we have the San Antonio Romance Authors. They all say, okay, I'm going to be at this coffee shop from 5 to 8. Anyone want to come and just sit? And we're going to like do writing sprints, you know, and it kind of keeps you accountable. And again, like you're saying, it can be very solitary sitting there trying to create people in your head to go talk to other people who do the same.
Yeah. And just being able to talk to people and ask questions. Some groups focus on critiques, some don't. Again, it's just a personal preference. Mm-hmm. One of the best things I've done for myself is give critiques to other people, because it forced me to sit down, really analyze a short story or a chapter of a novel, figure out what worked and what didn't, and then put it into words, really express it in a way that made sense to them. And going through that is just as useful as actually getting the feedback on your own work, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. I think, too, you go, oh, wait a minute, I think I do this. And this is how I fixed it. And I think anybody, too, if you're truly wanting to improve your writing, listening to positive critique, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's positive, but presented positively.
Yes.
That these are people that are trying to help you improve. So kind of put your ego aside, which is hard, and really just get down to it. So we have about 2 minutes left. So, Dan, I wanted to tell you thank you so much for coming on. I'm looking forward to everybody discovering your book, Titan Shade, and the first of the Carter Archives. And they can follow you on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Goodreads, correct?
That's correct.
Perfect.
And thank you so much
and
for having
book-
me on. It's I just want to say thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real delight, and you're so much fun to talk to. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And if you want to talk to Dan, you can contact him through contact@danstout.com. It's DANSTOUT.com. He's also on his website, DANSTOUT.com. And you can find him on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Goodreads. His book, Titan Shade, is out and a part of the Carter Archives, and you can go ahead and pick that up. It's a fun read, and get refreshed on the 1970s. If you weren't alive at the time, or if you were, you can rehash some of the wonderful technology everybody went through just to get a phone call done. So thank you so much, Dan, for coming on today. Please keep me informed of what you're doing, and let's have you back on when that new book comes out.
I would love to. That sounds great.
Thank you again. Y'all keep reading.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.